So I wanted to ask you first. I think about Congress, and I've talked to a lot of people who are disenfranchised, who say, why should I care? Let me try to ask you in a positive way. What's the most fun part of covering a largely dysfunctional Congress?
That's a good question. Sometimes the dysfunctionality is very entertaining, and it's kind of, if you don't laugh, you'll cry watching some of the shenanigans. But look, it's important. I mean, what Congress does every day affects our lives. And even when they don't do anything that affects our lives, when they don't get stuff done, sometimes when they almost do something really dangerous, like defaulting on the debt or shutting down the government for a prolonged period of time, that also is important. I think covering the White House and Congress, as frustrating as it can be to watch from the outside, is just really, really important for people to understand.
You've done this for some time. Is it different in Washington these days than it was several Congresses ago? I mean, do things operate differently? Do people talk differently? Does it feel different to you?
Yes. I would say that polarization is the single most important political dynamic in the United States today. Congress is extremely polarized. That's one of the main reasons, not the only reason, why we have gridlock, why very little gets done. But I think that several Congresses ago, you had more of an overlap between the two parties. There were actually moderate to conservative Democrats and moderate to liberal Republicans. And to the extent that they overlapped, they created the center of the political spectrum. And that's where compromises were made and deals got done. Now, that's very rare. I think that in today's Congress, in today's Senate, you don't have a single Democrat with a more conservative voting record than a single Republican. And in the old days, you did have some Republicans who were more liberal than a conservative Democrat. And that was the center of the electorate, the center of the political spectrum in Congress. So you don't have that anymore. So you do have this big gap between the two parties. You also have a phenomenon where members don't socialize like they used to. They go home on the weekends. They don't stay in town. They don't bring their families to Washington. So their wives don't get together. You know, polarization is not just about Congress, and it's not only because of gerrymandering, you know, the way districts are drawn to keep people safe. It's also the American public. I mean, people tend to live in places where they're surrounded by people who think like them. The media is polarized. People say, you know, MSNBC and Fox don't even cover the same natural disasters. So it's really permeating throughout the entire society, and I think that makes it much less likely that Congress will get stuff done. A Pew poll recently showed that 49% of Republicans and 33% of Democrats said they would be very sad if a member of their family married someone from the opposite party. So I do think that's kind of where we're at today. That doesn't mean that with leadership and political will, we can't come together on some of the big problems that need solving in this country. But right now, it isn't happening.
I had a congresswoman from Indiana's 5th District in here last week, and she talked about that leadership issue. And, of course, she placed it on the president, and the president has in turn placed it back on Congress, saying, you know, why can't we have Speaker Boehner help things out? And he's, of course, worried that if Mitch McConnell becomes Senate Majority Leader, then that's going to be even further gridlock. Is it clear to you that one side is not leading more than the other, or is it a complete void of leadership? Is one side doing better than the other?
I think that in certain cases, it's you know, the president and John Boehner were very close to making a big deal on entitlement and tax reform several times. And Boehner couldn't bring along his Tea Party base, and that didn't happen. There was a deal made on immigration reform. The Senate passed it, and the president was ready to sign it. He was even ready to compromise it further with the House, but the House couldn't get it passed. So I think that the Republican Party is a little more divided, more intensely divided than the Democrats right now. You know, Boehner has just had a harder time than Harry Reid, for example, keeping his troops together. On the other hand, I think that there's plenty of blame to go around. I do think it's a fair question for a voter who's looking at this election to say, yeah, I understand that control of the Senate is up for grabs, but what difference would it make? In other words, how would anyone know if instead of a narrow Democratic majority, you have a narrow Republican majority? Since nothing is getting done now, why would something get done if we had Republicans controlling the Senate? I think there is actually a potential a theoretical answer to that, which is that historically, divided Congresses, divided governments, meaning one party has control of both houses of Congress and one party has the White House, have been more productive than unified government, believe it or not, when one party has everything, or than a split Congress, which is what we have now. One party has the House, one party has the Senate. So it means that if the Republicans do end up with control of both houses of Congress, they'll have responsibility for governing. Theoretically, they would have to do something more than just stop the president's agenda. And because they are looking to 2016, where they would like to have the White House, assuming they take control of the Senate, it's possible that Republicans would see it in their interest to compromise with the president on any number of things. And the president, who's very interested in a legacy, would be more willing to compromise with the Republican Congress if we have one. So that is one theory, that you could actually get more done. Now, I think it's just as likely as we'll have continued gridlock. It would be a different kind of gridlock. It would be more clarifying gridlock. It would be clearer. You have Republicans on one side and in Congress and the president, Democrat, on the other side, as opposed to now when, you know, you've got Harry Reid and John Boehner kind of sharing control of Congress.
Is that idea of the message and the muddying of the message, people not sure who to believe, is that part of the problem here? Because you've got you essentially have three sides now, and if the Republicans take control of the Senate, you'd be down to two, which I think is more manageable in the minds of a lot of people trying to figure out, what do I believe, for whom do I vote?
Yeah, I think so. It would be more clarifying. Even if it's gridlock, it'll be more clarifying. You might have different kinds of fights instead of a lot of filibusters, although you still might have them, because certainly the Republicans, if they take control of the Senate, are not going to have a filibuster-proof majority. However, you might have veto fights. In other words, you might get the Republican Congress as a whole passing something and sending it to the president, and he vetoes it, and then you have a big fight about that. President Clinton had a Republican Congress, and they actually got a fair amount done. So it's not out of the question. I think that the next 2 years, if there is Republican control of Congress, will set the stage for the 2016 presidential elections. But also, I think it could bring a lot of surprises to people who are many voters who are just about ready to wash their hands completely of Washington.
Do you think that if the Republicans do take control of the Senate, does that potentially widen the 2016 field on especially on the Republican side? Because it seems like there are more clear possible Democratic frontrunners now than there are Republican frontrunners, and the GOP is waiting for someone to emerge as the standard bearer. And if you've got all of Congress, then you've got, you know, 400 potentially members who could say, hey, look, I'm the person.
Right. Well, you know, every member of Congress looks in the mirror and says, ooh, that looks like a president.
That's right.
I think that the Republican field is remarkably large right now. It's very wide. You're right. There is no front runner. If you see all the people who are thinking about running for president on the Republican side, they're all bunched up around 10-12% in the polls. You know, you've got Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Jeb Bush and Chris Christie and John Kasich and Scott Walker and Bobby Jindal and Mike Pence. I mean, there's so many people. And unlike 2012, they're all serious. They're senators. They're governors. Last time you had Mitt Romney and basically a bunch of pygmies. I mean, he was a giant, a redwood among the rest of them. This time I think you have a really big field, and it'll be one of the most interesting races on the Republican side just because there are so many. And there will be a real soul-searching debate in the Republican presidential primary about what direction the Republicans need to go in, because on the Democratic side, of course, we have one candidate, Hillary Clinton, with no apparent opposition. And she has the support of, you know, 65-70% of Democrats, which is extraordinary. I don't think we've ever had this situation. So all the action is going to be on the Republican side. And Republicans have a lot of serious thinking to do because they've lost the popular vote in the last 5 out of 6 presidential elections. Democrats went through this, too. They had to find a way out of the political wilderness when they had lost a lot of White House races from like the end of the 60s to the end of the 80s. And it really took Bill Clinton coming out and saying, we're going to change the party, we're going to move it to the center. And the question is, do Republicans think they have to do that or something like that to win the White House again?
I remember seeing a political scientist who said once that politics, at least of the last 100 years or so, has tended to go in these like 20-year cycles. And if you have something like George W. Bush becoming president in the midst of a bunch of Democrats, the question becomes, is the president at what happens with the president after him? So is he a blip on the radar or is he part of a movement? And at this point, it appears that presidency is historically speaking, more of a blip time-wise over the last 20 years.
You're talking about George W. Bush's presidency.
So the question is, does 2016 become another sort of tipping point year because you've got the end of a presidential reign where the guy's won the popular vote more than 50%, two consecutive terms, which hadn't happened since, what, Eisenhower? And so do you think that the next 2 years in Congress can get away from looking ahead to 2016? Can you do enough day of work and stop looking ahead to the next presidential election? Hmm. Are you hamstrung by what's ahead?
Hope springs eternal. That's a really good question. The problem, one of the problems in American politics is there's always an election 2 years ahead. And why do anything? Let's just hold on. Maybe we'll have the White House. Let's just hold on. Maybe we'll have the Senate majority. I think that that's a really good question. And a lot of the answer depends on what Republicans see in their interest. You know, what is the best way to set themselves up for a presidential run? Should they pass immigration reform, for instance? That's like the $60 million question. There are many Republicans who think they cannot win the White House again unless they pass immigration reform, which the Senate did, but the House was unable to do that. So that's a really important question. And the other question you're raising about whether George W. Bush was a blip in the midst of a long march towards a Democratic realignment or not, the way the Republicans answer that question will determine a lot about who they nominate and how they comport themselves in the next 2 years. So those are kind of all things that the Republicans need to figure out. There's no doubt that right now, structurally, in the Electoral College, the way we elect presidents, the Democrats have a structural advantage. There's just no doubt. When you look at the last 5 out of 6 presidential elections, you only need 270 electoral votes to win. And in the last 5 out of 6 elections, Democrats have won 242 electoral votes in every single one of them. In other words, they start with a base of, I think it's like 18 states in the District of Columbia that equals 242
electoral
votes. Yeah,
there's something like 180 safe Democratic electoral votes.
Yes, I mean, it's incredible. On the Republican side, in the last 5 out of 6 elections, they've only won 102 electoral votes each time. In other words, they can count on a base of 102. The Democrats can count on a base of 242. That is really something. And when you look at the electorate, the fastest growing parts of the electorate, sometimes we call them the rising American electorate, RAE, or the Obama electorate, younger, browner, more single, unmarried women. So all of those demographic chunks lean heavily Democratic, and they are the fastest growing groups in the electorate. The Republican coalition, older, whiter, more rural, more married, more church going, they're shrinking. So demographically, Republicans are behind the eight ball. And they have to figure out how to solve that problem, too. So Democrats have some structural advantages. On the other hand, it is extremely hard to become a third-term president. In other words, it's extremely hard to succeed a president, a two-term president of your own party. And George H.W. Bush is the only president who's ever done that in the modern era. He's the only one who's succeeded a two-term president of his own party. So Hillary, assuming she's the nominee, will have a really hard job because historically it just hasn't been done more than once.
So let's go back to how this affects you and how this affects how you do your job.
Yes, that's always the subtitle of every Washington memoir. You
right.
know, I was there too. If only they'd listen to me. Right.
So there's a lot of Sturm und Drang right now because we're a week out from an election as we speak. And you've got a presidential election looming with a potentially different makeup of Washington. Does the next 2 years for you, as you forecast it now, look different than the last two have been?
Yes. Now that we've changed the conversation to, and what about me? Yes, there's no doubt about it. I would say that for me, because I'm the national political correspondent, the next 2 years is, I mean, for better or for worse, all about getting ready for 2016. And I think that's the prism we're going to look at Congress through. Even there will be legislative fights, I hope. There will be legislative progress, I hope. But that's always going to be one of the filters that we use as political journalists. You know, how does this kind of lead us up to the next election? Excuse me. And one of the things that is just a feature of American politics is that there's always the next election. It's extremely present, especially when it's a presidential election. There's tremendous attention already being paid to every Republican hopeful and to Hillary. I mean, Hillary now has a permanent reporter assigned to her from the White House, from the New York Times, from CNN. I mean, this is how these races are covered, you know, 4 years in advance. And I just did a story for Morning Edition that was on this morning, actually, about field operations. Those never end anymore. In the old days, you had to get out the vote efforts. The Republicans used to call it the 72-hour project. That's almost a joke now. 72 hours before Election Day, they would send out their get out the vote operation. Now it's 7,200 hours. I don't really know what the equivalent, what equals, you know, 3 years. But they are going to have ground operations, volunteer coordinators, data, you know, field, all that in the field, in key states, all the time. It will never, ever end. So, yes, I mean, the answer is the next 2 years are going to be covered looking towards a presidential election. And also, there are big, important issues facing the country. And I think that if you asked any member of Congress secretly what are the most important things for Congress to work on, there would be an amazing consensus. They might disagree on the details, but everybody understands that we need tax reform and entitlement reform. We need immigration reform. We need investments in infrastructure and education. And maybe some people would say we need to get some trade deals passed. I mean, that there's an incredible amount of agreement on that. There's almost zero agreement on exactly how you get to each one.
Now, just to bring this completely full circle, what about you as an informed voter? How do you view the national figures or the congressional figures for whom you vote when you cast your vote? Assuming you do, I know not all journalists do. Yeah. Are you disappointed? Are you hopeful? How would you characterize yourself looking at the Congress people who represent you?
Well, I would say that in general, first of all, I come from the District of Columbia. I live in the District of Columbia where we don't have representation. However, I would say looking at the at least at the field of presidential hopefuls, they're a pretty good field. I think the American people are going to get the race they deserve next time. I really do. I think if it's Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side and any number of the Republican candidates, I think that will be a good, serious choice. And I think that most of the people who run for Congress want to do the right thing. They're motivated by public service. But the system that they operate in has tremendous forces kind of pushing them to one side or the other, making polarization worse. And I actually think there are some reforms that could be made that would make it easier for people to work across the aisle. One thing that I'm interested in as a journalist is the electoral reform that you see in California, for instance, the top two primary, where they have open primaries now. Instead of a Democratic primary and a Republican primary, everybody can vote. And the top two winners of the primary, even if they're both from the same party, go on and compete in the general election.
And then, of course, there's the move in places like Indiana's talked about it, Florida's talked about it, and a number of states have done it, having the nonpartisan commission draw the boundary lines. Because Indiana, we knew 6 months ago who was going to win all nine congressional races. It wasn't a question.
Yep. And there was an amazing article, I think the Post did it, about I think in South Carolina or North Carolina, where there is no campaigning. There's really basically no election because everybody knows who's going to win because it's so non-competitive. But I think that the combination of the nonpartisan redistricting, which California also has, and the top two primary system has at least, you know, California is an unusual place to do this experiment because it's a very Democratic state. It hasn't changed the Democratic makeup of the state legislature. I think it's still about two-thirds Democratic. But what it has done, apparently, is the Democrats who are elected now are slightly more moderate, more willing to cross the aisle to make a deal because they're not worried about getting a primary challenge from their left because there are no more one-party primaries. So they're competing for all kinds of voters, independents, Republicans, and Democrats in their primaries. And the same thing is true for Republicans. So that's something, you know, it's worth watching.
So it sounds like what you're saying is it's the system that needs a little bit of help more than the people inhabiting that system.
I would say the system needs some help, but the people also need – I mean, let's not let them off the hook here. I think leadership is really, really important. You have to be willing to either work really hard to bring your base along if they disagree with you and you want to move to the center, take some risky votes. I think it's not just the system. It's also leadership. And it's also, as we talked about in the beginning of this conversation, members of different parties forming actual relationships with each other the way that used to be the norm in Washington.
I have a friend who's a political scientist who says there just aren't a lot of mouth-breathing moderates out there. And I wonder if the way to moderation is through having dysfunction and then you get back eventually to where everyone said, wow, that really stunk. Maybe we should just go back to the way it once was.
Well, you know, that's I agree with that. And one of the things that's going to happen with some of these problems are we're going to get to the point where we can't kick the can down the road anymore. I mean, during the last administration, during this administration, we've gotten pretty close to a deal on tax reform and entitlement reform, you know, a big fiscal grand bargain with House Speaker Boehner and President Obama. Now, it's failed every time. But when we get close to 2020 and the baby boomers start retiring, you're not going to get the luxury of waiting another year to try again. And there's only so long, at least on the fiscal side, that the rest of the world is going to lend us money at such low interest rates. At right now, the American economy is the best looking horse in the glue factory. I mean, everybody else is so much worse off than us that people are still willing to invest and buy our debt. But that's not going to go on forever. So there is a kind of limit to how long we can ignore these problems.
So even if people are disenfranchised this midterm election, there will only be so long they can afford to feel disenfranchised.
I think so.
All right. Anything else you want to add?
No, it's been a lovely conversation. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.